Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's July 7th. Currently 60 degrees here in Old Town Park City, and 60 degrees in Heber Valley as well. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Monday. It's time for your Wasatch Back forecast. As we move into a new work week, we're looking at lots of sunshine as we go throughout this week. But one thing you're going to notice, especially for the first half of the week, is temperatures are going to be warming up each and every afternoon. As we look at your forecast here for Park City, as we go throughout your Monday, look for lots of sunshine. Temperatures are going to be warming up into the mid to upper 80s for your daytime highs. As we go into the Heber Valley, look for lots of sunshine. Temperatures climbing into the low to mid 90s for highs today. Make sure you have that sunscreen, SPF 30 or greater, or you could burn in less than 20 minutes out there. So be very careful with that very high UV index. As we go into your Tuesday, you guessed it, more sunshine is expected. Sunshine and hot conditions out there. High temperatures in the Heber Valley will be climbing into the mid 90s for highs. As we look at the Park City area, we're looking at high temperatures climbing to around 90 degrees as well. Again, it's going to be a hot one all across the region as we go throughout your Tuesday. Wednesday, we're going to notice the winds picking up a little bit out of the south and west. It'll be breezy, but it'll be a hot breeze as we have a cold front actually on the approach. Yeah, a cold front. We like to hear that. High temperatures before that front arrives for your Wednesday afternoon will still be around 90 for Park City. And we're looking at those high temperatures into the mid to upper 90s for our friends in the Heber Valley. So again, it still will be very warm as we go throughout your Wednesday. But that cold front moves through Wednesday night. And that means as we head into Thursday, we've got some cool air on the way. High temperatures in Park City will drop down to around the low 80s for highs for your Thursday afternoon, with highs into the upper 80s. That's it for the Heber Valley. And by the time we get towards your Friday, high temperatures will remain into the low to mid 80s for Park City, with highs only around 90 in the Heber Valley. But cooling trend only lasts for a small bit, because by the weekend, that sunshine sticks around and high pressure builds back in. That means highs returning to the mid 90s in the Heber Valley, and highs in the upper 80s around Park City. That's your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Kane.
Stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be checking in with Summit County Chief Deputy Casey Bates, along with PIO Skyler Talbot from the Sheriff's Office, with an update on how the Independence Day holiday went. Heber City PIO Ryan Bunnell with a preview of this week's City Council meeting, as well as some other city updates. And musician and director of TedFest, Ryan Shoup, with details on this year's music festival in Wallsburg. A note, Heber City and TedFest are both financial supporters of KPCW. Well, a group of Summit County residents want a judge to order the county clerk to verify the signature she rejected in a petition to put Dakota Pacific's development to a countywide vote. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more.
A petition filed by the residents Thursday claims Summit County Clerk Eve Furse's decision to invalidate the packets was capricious and not supported by state law. They want her to count the signatures in the rejected packets, and if they meet the legal threshold, let voters decide if the Summit County Council was right in approving a controversial Kimball Junction development. The petitioners include Angela Mesqueda, Reed Galen, Ruby Diaz, Dana Williams, and Brendan Weinstein. Diaz and Weinstein were among the seven initial sponsors to petition for a referendum. During the initial petition process, Furse's office rejected 30 of 77 total signature packets after seeing they were three-hole punched, then subsequently spiral-bound. Furse said photos show some three-hole punched pages were physically separated from their packet as a whole and invalidated every three-hole punched packet on the grounds they should be, quote, bound as a unit throughout the petition process. The petition filed in 3rd District Court Thursday denies any pages from the rejected packets, quote, were separated or circulated apart from those packets. It states that they were submitted to the clerk as bound units and that Furse doesn't have evidence to the contrary. The petitioners also say Utah law does not discriminate between or mandate a particular type of binding and contend a prior Utah Supreme Court ruling backs that up. Furse and Summit County spokesperson Derek Sitaway declined to comment Thursday. The case is on 3rd District Judge Richard Mrozek's desk. No hearings have been set. The development at the center of the controversy is Dakota Pacific's 725-unit neighborhood and public-private partnership with Summit County in Kimball Junction near the Skullcandy headquarters. The project has drawn public pushback, especially about adding people and traffic to a busy area of the county over the past 5 years. The seven referendum sponsors say they collected more than 6,000 signatures, enough to put it on the ballot this November. First's office only verified 3,214 signatures and formally declared the petition insufficient June 23rd. Separately, Dakota Pacific has asked for a new but largely similar agreement through the Summit County Planning Department under a 2025 state law written to greenlight the development. County officials believe such an agreement would make the referendum on the old agreement irrelevant, but the new agreement could still be appealed to the county council and then to Third District Court if the county manager approves it. Summit County's a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Summit County Sheriff's Office, I have Chief Deputy Casey Bates along with PIO Skylar Talbot. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's see, Skylar, you said you were out of town. Casey, it sounds like you were working. So how did things go over the Independence Day holiday?
It was a really busy weekend, Leslie. Our Sheriff's Office was extremely busy throughout the county. We were actually participants in all three parades this year. We were in the Oakley Parade. We had our ATV, our motors, and our Mounted Patrol in that parade. I joined our Mounted Patrol doing the color guard with our honor guard. I joined Chief Carpenter in the Jeep. And wow, what a turnout. It was a great parade. And then we went to Hennifer later in the afternoon, where our Mounted Patrol, our motors, and our ATV team participated in that parade. So we were really busy, not to mention all of the other events throughout the county and everything that was happening. All of our deputies were widespread, and I would like to thank them for everything that they did this weekend. They took time away from their families, and so I want to thank their families as well for supporting that.
Yeah, let's talk. We were waiting for the parade to start here in Park City, and then we saw the cops going the wrong way. So, and then it was like, oh, we saw the horses walking up the street instead of down the street. This was the mounted posse. So what happened there?
So what happened was our truck and horse trailer with our Mounted Patrol, the horses, got stuck in traffic, and the people running the event kept asking where our Mounted Patrol was for our color guard. And I asked Chief Carpenter to send the motors down to get our Mounted Patrol, and they headed up the wrong way through the parade. So they got to do the parade twice. With a police escort the first time.
Yeah. Okay. So it was just a traffic issue.
It was mm-hmm. a traffic issue, and they got ready very quickly and were able to come down and do the color guard with our honor guard, and it turned out really well. But yeah, they got stuck in traffic. Can you imagine? I mean, everyone saw the traffic, and they have a truck and a trailer, so it's not easy to navigate traffic up here with that.
Okay, let's talk about fires. Any fires reported that you know of?
We had a couple fires throughout the weekend, brush fires just along the freeway. Other than that, up in the mountains, I don't recall seeing anything just off of the freeways and a couple responses that way. But I could be wrong. Those are the ones that I know about.
Yeah. You know, we've been really fortunate. You know, the few brush fires that have come in, the North Summit, South Summit fire departments in Park City, they've been, you know, great. Their response times are amazing, and getting them stomped out rather quickly.
Yep.
And what about fireworks? Any issues there with people setting those off illegally?
Yes. Even though we sent out the state warning, the restrictions on the fireworks, we tried to get everyone aware that, you know, it was illegal this year just due to the lack of water in the vegetation. It's dangerous. But I actually looked up on the CAD this weekend, specifically on Thursday or on the 4th, and there we had several reports of fireworks. And of course, we're trying to get to them all, but we have other calls that we're going to. But yes, unfortunately, people were letting off fireworks.
Yeah, but no citations that you're aware of that were issued? You just weren't able to find who did it?
I'm not sure about the citations. I know that there were a lot of calls on the screen. I don't know about the citations.
Okay. Anything else about the weekend you wanted to mention?
No, I just hope that everyone had a great 4th of July, and there was a lot going on, and I went to the Oakley rodeo, which was fantastic. It was a really good weekend, and I hope everyone else was able to enjoy the weekend as well.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the restore, where they found firearms in donation bags. This is kind of one of a kind.
Yeah, so, you know, not something we see every day, but yeah, we were notified by some employees at that business, and they'd become aware that there were four firearms that they had located just while going through a larger shipment. I mean, you know, these folks are getting donated shipments from all over the place, and came across these firearms, which they recognized as, you know, being pretty out of the ordinary. So they called us, and our deputies ran those serial numbers. Did turn out that the firearms had been listed on our database, or a national database we use, as being either lost or stolen. So we took possession of those firearms, and we're now in the process of getting them back to the ATF, who originally made the listing, and then they can then, you know, get the firearms back to whatever organization, business, you know, accidentally sent them as part of their donation.
Okay, so the perhaps individuals.
You know, so the firearms, they were actually all in their original packaging. It appears, and we don't know this for sure, but it appears that this would have been like a larger business making the donation, and those items just mistakenly found their way into whatever larger box was being donated. So we don't think this was an individual. It's more likely a business that made this mistake.
Yeah, but I was wondering just the individual firearms. They don't belong to an individual?
Correct, yeah. Correct. That's what we believe.
Okay. And luckily, I guess you said in the original packaging, so not loaded.
Correct. Oh, yeah. No ammunition was found with the firearms. They were, you know, just like you'd find them in a box at a store. You know, boxes were still sealed, stickers were still on, so there's nothing to indicate they ever even left the box.
Okay. And as we saw, certainly over the 4th, just everybody and their sister riding e-bikes today. certainly a lot of all the kids out of school as well and out on their e-bikes. Have you seen, I mean, we had reported about a couple of them earlier last month, and, you know, just really some close calls. What else are you seeing around?
Well, I mean, Leslie, this is something that I believe you and I talked about, 2 years ago? We started talking about e-bikes. And I think there's a distinction. We have to make a distinction between e-bikes and e-motorcycles. And that's what we're seeing. And I think this is a community problem. A lot of people, and I've seen, you know, the editorials, I've seen the articles, and people are asking why law enforcement isn't doing more citations or, you know, taking control of this. And I think it's a community problem. I think what we have is juveniles that don't know what they're on, and we have parents that are buying very expensive bikes. I mean, they're thousands of dollars. And what we're talking about are the e-motorcycles, and e-motorcycles are considered a motorized vehicle, and they go very fast. They'll go over 55 miles an hour, and they are not allowed on our sidewalks. They're not allowed to anyone. They have OHV regulations, or off-highway vehicle regulations. They need a helmet. You have to have the you have to take the OHV class. And these are the Surons, the Tellurias, the Kicks, the Segways, those types of things. When we talked a couple years ago, we only talked about e-bikes and the classifications. And e-bikes are pedal assist. They go from 20 miles an hour to 28 miles an hour. They have age restrictions where, you know, if you are, I believe, under 14,
correct, yeah,
you know, you have to have a parent or guardian with you to ride these things. And that's just not happening. So what we're trying to do is find this balance between education and enforcement. And the education piece comes when we find a juvenile, excuse me, on these and we let them know that they can't be on these. And we call the parent or guardian and let them know. So we're trying to find that balance. And if we do find that person again, because we document that, then we...
I mean, and you know, if we're... I think the chief made a good point. You know, it's a community problem, and it seems that there, we sort of have half the community that doesn't want to see any enforcement. They think, you know, kids should be out enjoying the outdoors, recreating, which I think as the sheriff's office we 100% encourage and agree with.
Definitely.
We've got people on the other end of the spectrum, though, who they want us to impound every single e-bike or e-motorcycle that we see. And so as the sheriff's office, we're sort of trying to find a balance that, you know, safety is a top priority, and that goes back to the difference between these e-bikes and e-motorcycles. And it's so frustrating to see these e-motorcycles be classified or talked about as e-bikes because they're simply not. I mean, anything that's over 750 watts is not a classified e-bike. And we're seeing these e-motorcycles, some, you know, upwards of 2,500 watts. I mean, you know, we're talking 3.5, 4, sometimes 5 or 6 times what legally is allowed. And I think a lot of parents are just completely unaware of the capabilities of these machines. And, you know, when we have kids out there doing 60 plus miles an hour in neighborhoods and business districts, that's an incredibly unsafe thing.
Yeah, but even the e-bikes, I mean, I know there's kids much younger than 14.
Absolutely.
Just riding a regular e-bike.
Yes.
So those are the ones you're also looking for?
We are. We're stopping all of them because we see them. And an example, I was talking to some officers on Main Street the other day, and they don't know the roads of the rules of the road, and they blow through stop signs. They cross traffic when they shouldn't. They're coming across crosswalks, and people. A good example was when you're coming out of a neighborhood in a vehicle and you see somebody on an e-bike or something coming towards you, you don't think that bike is coming towards you at 30 miles an hour or 55. And I really hope that, you know, we can do some education. I know that the sheriff and I have been talking about with our school resource officers that we want to educate within the schools. We want to start giving our SROs and having the schools allow us to start educating through that route and hopefully educate the parents as well and do classes. So we're doing the education piece all over. We're also working collaboratively with Basin Rec and Park City Police. And so we're all trying to get together and making everyone aware of what's going on, education, and helping kids be safe.
Okay, well, moving on then, we know that schools now all have their own school resource officers, but school's out till August, so how are you keeping them busy?
So they have been in a lot of training. There's some training that all of them have to go through. They've actually been, we haven't put anyone in place yet, so they actually are still on the road, working our patrol enforcement, but they are going to be starting and being put in place in August to be moving into the schools. We just hosted it's called NASRO, National SRO Association, the level one certification. We did that at Ecker Hill, and we had attendees from across Utah and even out of state to come to that that certification. This certification helps deputies start to focus on school-specific laws, enforcement, safety issues, and how to address those inside an educational environment. So that's what they've been doing, and the 1st of August they will be put in place and start entering the schools and getting familiar with those.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about that tragic news last month when a missing 2-year-old boy went missing and found in a drain channel. It was deemed a tragic accident, but we haven't heard. I mean, did he slip and fall? I mean, was it a drowning? I mean, what happened there?
Yeah, so, you know, the investigation as far as, you know, the investigation at the scene, that's all been wrapped up. Leslie, what we're waiting for now is an official report from the Utah Medical Examiner's Office. So we're unable to actually close the case until we receive that report. However, I'm comfortable saying that, you know, in conversations with our investigators, it does appear this was an accident. It appears that the infant was asleep in the trailer, at some point left the trailer. There was a access to a small stream or drainage canal that ran directly behind the trailer. So it's believed, and again, without that report, I can't say definitively, but it's believed that the young child did either slip and fall into that that body of water, and his body, unfortunately, very sadly, was located about a mile downstream from where they think he accessed that.
Okay, it's just been so dry, I didn't realize if there was water in there or not.
My understanding was it was running, yeah.
All right. And also, I got to bring this up because it's just, I mean, got to be terrifying to you folks who are first responders. You know, a couple of weeks ago, the wackadoodle in Idaho who starts the fire, then ambushes the first responders. I mean, I don't know the whole story, but maybe you can just talk a little bit about that. I mean, how do you, I mean, if something were like that to happen here, I mean, how do you get people back out to do their jobs? I mean, it's like, and why would anybody want to do these jobs? I mean, it's just how awful.
No,
first of all, I just want to say that this was a horrific event. And our hearts and thoughts go out to the Coeur d'Alene Fire Department and their families and that community. What I think about is those firefighters who were headed to a routine call and thinking about headed to a brush fire, and their intentions were stopping that fire and from endangering the community. And when they arrived, it turned into chaos and ended in tragedy. We now learn that that fire was set intentionally, and I've been following that story. To answer your question, Leslie, we have great communication with our fire department, and from what I understand, you know, it was the communication that helped these from more people getting hurt. It was the ability to get on the radio, let people know what's happening, and taking it from there. So to answer your question, what we would do in those situations is communicate effectively, use our communication, and, you know, do exactly what they did, set up perimeters, set up all of our containment, and do what we're trained to do. But it was horrific, and my heart goes out to them. I appreciate Chief Emery, Chief Nielsen, and Chief Thorell. We have a great relationship with them, and I appreciate all they do.
Did you want to add something, Skylar?
Well, you know, I was just going to make the point. I was actually talking to with our SWAT commander, and found it interesting. Our SWAT team was actually just in the very beginning, you know, preparations of actually responding up to Idaho to help assist with this.
Yep.
So it's very comforting. I heaven forbid something like that strike closer to home. You know, certainly inside Summit County, I am confident that, you know, our SWAT team and tactical units would be able to deploy rather quickly. And I thought it was great that, you know, they were willing to extend, you know, their own resources to go up and help in Idaho. That obviously didn't end up happening, but
right.
It was something that was being talked about very early on.
Yeah, I mean, so do you need to, or do you, you know, provide any kind of counseling or something for people on your force that may be traumatized by this?
Absolutely. We have debriefing teams. We have situations set up that if anyone is experiencing anything from this, that we have people that they can go talk to.
All right. Finally, we just wanted to mention the Citizens Academy underway. How's that going, Skylar?
Oh, man. The Citizens Academy is off to a great start, Leslie. We're about halfway through. I believe someone you know very well, Connor Thomas, is actually participating this year. So I hope that, you know, when things wrap up, he has some good insight to give. But yeah, we're about halfway through. You know, we've done some of the more fun things. We've done our firearms. We've done, you know, our virtual reality trainer. We've still got a lot coming up, though. We'll, you know, we'll have our SWAT night here in a few weeks, get the chance to shoot some pretty cool sniper rifles, maybe do some explosive breaching, things like that. Mounted patrol, search and rescue, those are always really, really hot topics. But yeah, things are great. We've got a large class this year. I think we've got upwards of 30 people on the roster, so it's you know, it's a full night every Tuesday, but we love it. Things are going great, and I think everyone's having a really good time.
So you do this once a year?
We do it once a year. Yep, every summer we do this. There has been mention of maybe upping that to twice a year. We're getting a lot of folks that are interested, which is great. So don't be shocked if, you know, next year you start to see this happening twice a year.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
Well, I just want to thank Skylar for everything he does. He is behind this 100%, and he makes this possible. And he goes through great, now, he goes through a lot of work to
now
get
I've
this
doubled
done.
It up by telling you that maybe we're going to do two. Now
yeah,
I've kind of sealed my
that.
Fate on that.
Thank you.
All right. Casey Bates, Skylar Talbot, thanks for your time this
thanks,
morning.
Leslie.
Thanks, Leslie.
The Heber City Council meets tomorrow at 4 o'clock. On the phone with a preview of the agenda, I have Heber City PIO Ryan Bunnell. Good morning, Ryan. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, so let's start with how the Independence Day celebration went. This was the first time that a parade was held in Heber City.
Oh, I think it was fantastic. I think it was received quite well by the community. We had great attendance. We had great participation. So we just couldn't be happier with the way this parade went.
Yeah. So unlike here in Park City, the Red, White, and Blue Festival in Heber City is not a city function, but rather its own nonprofit that organizes it all?
That is correct.
Okay. So what's the city's role in it?
You know, the city, Heber City Municipal has tried to sponsor certain events over the years that bring attraction to the community, that bring revenue to the businesses. Heber City's role with Red, White, and Blue would be much, I would compare it to, if you recall, Cowboy Poetry Gathering that happened, you know, for over 25 years down in the Heber Valley. Heber City Municipal provides some of their resources, which could be, you know, with, you know, promotion through social media. There is some monetary donation that goes into it. If the resources are needed, like with our public works department, for example, to help set up the park, you know, public works has certainly had a role to play in that. But, you know, I think that with the broader vision here is Heber City is trying to create gathering spaces downtown and opportunities downtown to try and create a culture and an energy and an excitement about downtown Heber that may not have always been there.
All right. So any fires or firework issues you're aware of that happened over the holiday?
You know, we at the last minute, it was recommended by Wasatch County Fire to increase some of the traditional restricted area because of how dry everything's been. You know, just several days before, you know, while the fireworks stands were open, we put out a new map encouraging citizens to be, really it was the city centers where we were encouraging people to discharge those fireworks. And that's because there's it's more regularly irrigated and it's closer to the fire department should there be an incident. I had a great conversation with our chief of police leading up to this interview just about how the weekend went. Yes, there were some people that chose to do their own thing, but for the most part, the citizens were responsive to the request. There were, in fact, he was telling me about an incident where a resident came down to one of the, was lighting fireworks in one of our new roundabouts. Why? Because it had been prohibited in their neighborhood and they had these fireworks they had purchased and the roundabout was a public zone that was within, you know, the safe area to discharge those fireworks. So I think that the community responded well and, you know, there's always going to be a couple of folks that choose to do their own thing, but all in all, we had a happy 4th. There were no fires that were reported. Yeah, I had a great view of the fireworks from kind of up on the east bench in Heber, and it was really a really special view because you could see the highlight of Timpanogos with kind of the glow behind it, and there were fireworks going. You could see them all the way to Midway, and I think that's special about the Heber Valley. You can, you know, the citizens here do get really excited about the 4th and Pioneer Day, and I think that the holiday went really well.
Okay. Last week, the Heber City Council approved the $2.2 million purchase of the Buys property on Main Street. So what did that buy the city? What did you get for that money?
That property is located within the historic core, so that's our Zone C3. And it is strategic because there is a long-term vision that has been, that we've worked on for years, actually, in coordination with urban developer Roger Brooks, to try and create more of these gathering opportunities in downtown Heber. Part of that plan involves a pedestrian walkway that could go from the Heber City Tabernacle, the Heber City offices, over to the new main stage. that buys property is within that strategic corridor. So Heber City has basically put out to any of those property owners in that area, if it comes to a point where they'd like to sell, Heber City is politely asking for a first right of refusal. You know, would you please come talk to us if you're thinking about selling your property, because we're interested. And that's exactly what happened with this buys deal. You know, I had a great conversation with Lori Wynn about this before the decision was made in council. You know, she talked a little bit about where she was coming from as the co-publisher and editor of the Wasatch Wave. And I think that both parties are happy about this. It's because it's within that strategic corridor, and that property, even if it ends up being resold down the road, it will help to enact this vision of having a downtown Heber that is pedestrian friendly, walkable, and has those sorts of amenities that would make it nice for people to come downtown and spend an evening.
So eventually the plan is then to tear the building down?
No. The plan right now is that Wave Publishing has been extended a very competitive lease, which will allow them to operate as long as Lori deems that necessary. I could speculate, of course, and say that the building could be used maybe to store some of the park amenities. I know that was discussed at one point in time, that if we start doing all of this programming in our downtown park, you know, where are you going to put, you know, the life-size chess pieces should you choose to do a big chessboard? You know, where are you going to put stuff? Perhaps it's something like that. Really, it's to be determined. The important thing is as we're gearing up and trying to convince the private sector that this plan is implementable and happening, we need to have some of those properties in place to show that we are serious.
Okay. Now, how has that Jordan L. Ridge master plan changed to give the community reinvestment area the money to buy the building? Because that's where it came from, it sounds like.
That is correct. A month or so, I don't remember the exact meeting date, but it was several months ago, council made a decision to allow existing MDAs to liquidate some of their affordable housing credits. And that's what happened here. And it was kind of a discussion that started a ways back. You have to understand that the affordable housing allocation for the Jordan L. Ridge development was pre-pandemic. Things have naturally changed since then. Going back to the negotiating table allowed the city to create some additional flexibility with Jordan L. Ridge for those affordable housing credits that didn't exist before because the need wasn't there when we first did their master development agreement. So this again was one of those, in my opinion, a win-win decision and a very proactive and a clever move by council. I think that both parties got some gain out of this. And then, as forementioned, so the property was acquired with that funded. It's not impossible to say that down the road, you know, it could be 30 years from now. That's a lot of times the timeline we talk about with, you know, municipal promoted development. You know, so it could be up to 30 years. The property could be acquired by a private sector, the buys property, for example. And then housing could be built onto there, which it is zoned for. The general zoning in C3 is three stories with retail on the bottom and then two stories of residential above it. I think it will look a lot like what you have up in Park City in between the Summit Watch Marriott and Main Street. It would be a very similar concept to that. So I think that while it might sound controversial at first, I think that this deal that Heber City struck with Jordan L. Ridge is very strategic. I think it will give some more flexibility. The affordable housing will come down closer to Highway 40 instead of being up on top of the ridge line. The AMI is going to be more flexible, so that will make it more open to a broader base of people. So in turn, what happened is Jordan L. Ridge did sell off some of their affordable housing allocations, but the affordable housing allocation that remains, which is still considerable, will probably be better suited for the market as it stands today.
So any idea how much the CRA has spent on acquiring downtown property and as well as paying for the park there?
You know, Leslie, I don't have that number right in front of me, and I would hate to put out a number that's not accurate. So respectfully, I've got to pass on that one.
All right. What are the latest plans for the improvements for downtown parking?
Well, downtown parking, we are currently in negotiation with Wasatch County and Wasatch County Fire, also for some strategic property acquisition. Wasatch County is building a new administration building just farther south down on Highway 40. And the fire department has just recently completed their new building, which is over off 12th South here in downtown. When those properties become available, it is proposed that there would be a nice option for downtown parking there. I think initially what will happen is it would probably be, just an open lot. Long-term, again, back to that 30-year plan, we have looked towards models like over at China Bridge, where there may actually be, a greater parking facility there. See, the problem that council is trying to address is that there aren't parking spots available downtown for the businesses to meet code and have a thriving business at the same time. So they've really been trying to figure out some of these problems on how we could have these events downtown and not have it impose on all of the residents and all of the residential streets. So in the immediate timeline, when the Wasatch County Administration Building and the Fire Department deals are negotiated and final, which from the city's point of view, we hope that an agreement is made to where Heber City can acquire those properties as well. We may see immediately some parking relief downtown in that area. Longer term, we're looking at, the Central Heber Overlay Zone and some options where we might be able to do some infrastructure improvement to downtown streets, the minor collectors of town, create some more diagonal parking. We're very aware of the problem, and we're doing the best that we can to sensitively and strategically increase those parking areas.
Okay. Real quick here, what's the latest on the water and sewer line replacement? Is that project going to get finished this year?
Oh, man, we're scheduled for, if everything goes without a hiccup, we're thinking September. Yeah, this has been, we're in 5 years now. Such a needed upgrade. And if I can, I just want to thank the citizens of Heber that have been patient with us. Those water and sewer lines were in dire need of replacement. And this is just such a positive thing for the residents of the older part of Heber as they're getting updated infrastructure and bringing that right up into the 21st century so that they have those modern amenities that most everybody else has been enjoying for some time without thinking about it.
Okay, Brian, I've got to leave it there. I'm out of time. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Leslie.
Ryan Bunnell is the PIO for Heber City. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Well, formerly known as the Wasatch Music Festival, the annual TED Fest happening later this month. And on the phone with details, I have Ryan Shoup, son of the founder of the festival. Ted Shoup, good morning to you, Ryan. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so let's start with the details. When, where?
It's July 18th. Well, it's technically July 18th to the 20th, but the music is on the 18th and the 19th. The 20th is Sunday, and there's like a free pancake breakfast for anybody that stays over. And there's like a little gospel jam in the morning. But so it's kind of like a lot of music on Friday and Saturday, and then some fun on Sunday morning. So.
Okay, and it happens out at the end of the road in Wallsburg, huh?
Yeah, you kind of wind through town. There's a place called the Richard Erickson Foundation Ranch. If you pull that up on Google, you'll be able to find it. But yeah, you kind of wind through town, you go up a little thing, and it kind of goes up behind a little, a mountain hill, and it was kind of this really great open ranch area. And there's a couple stages up there that we have, and another smaller stage, so three different stages. 25, you know, different bands and performers. And it's, you know, kind of Celtic bluegrass, blues, you know, folk, roots rock, a lot of different roots-oriented music.
All right. So how are tickets sold? You can buy day passes or a weekend pass plus a camping fee?
Yeah. So all kids 16 and under are free. So that's kind of nice. And then you just go to TedFestMusic.com. And you can either buy a Friday pass or a Saturday pass, a weekend pass, in camping on there, you know, whatever combination you want.
All right. So for those who may not be familiar, I mean, tell us what Ted Fest is and how it got started.
Well, my dad, he's kind of a big supporter of bluegrass music originally, although he has owned a lot of music venues over the years and operated them. And so he does like helping a lot local and regional bands have a place to perform, and he really, you know, likes just supporting music in general. And so he was you know, kind of brainstorming on some stuff. I told him, hey, you should start a festival, you know, because you have done these venues for so long, and you just know so many bands, and you've always helped them so much. And he said, okay, that's a pretty good idea. So, you know, he started this festival, and it's you know, kind of in the, you know, mindset of a lot of the festivals they have in other places. And, you know, in Colorado, for example, you know, they have a, you know, Telluride Bluegrass Country Festival, you know, that one. A lot of different festivals like that. It's kind of in that same vein. We don't have as many here in Utah. And so that's kind of how he started. And then eventually along the way, you know, he said, well, Ryan, you should, you know, come help me and, you know, help us get more organized. And so that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, how's your dad doing? I know he's in his mid-80s.
Yeah. You know, he's still doing pretty well. I mean, you know, you're seeing the effects of age, you know, kind of creeping in there, but he's still, you know, up and at him. And he really loves this festival and is really excited about, you know, helping put it on. And, you know, he's always just, you know, up, working on things like this. And if you know my dad, he's just a character of a guy, and, you know, always just, you know, he's just a funny guy, always, you know, wanting to talk to everybody, and you know, he just wants to put on a big party and have everybody come for a festival.
All right. Well, walk us through some of the highlights of this year's lineup. Any standout artists or events you want to mention?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, there's so many bands, of course I can't mention them all, but, you know, there's some really cool younger bands. There's like this band called Sea Slack and Local Kin and Last Wild Buffalo. They're kind of younger, and, you know, it's kind of cool to see the youth kind of adopting this kind of roots music. And then, you know, we have a guy named Tony Holiday who does blues, and he's, you know, from Salt Lake, and he's, I think, currently living in Nashville, but he's coming back for this. I'm going to be playing there, Ryan Shipp and the Rubber Band. You know, and we're kind of a, you know, kind of a bluegrass rock thing. And I host a jam at the end of the night on Saturday. There's Swagger, which maybe, you know, kind of a, you know, a Celtic rock, really great band. There's, you know, so there's a lot of different bluegrass, some duos, some folk duos. There's just a big variety there. There's some singer-songwriter. There's a singer-songwriter contest in the morning of Saturday. And we feature those singer-songwriters on stage. You know, a lot of different stuff like that. So it's a really fun time.
Yeah, and I've been there a few times. I mean, that Saturday night jam is like incredible. You allow pretty much anybody that wants to come up and play to play. Give them all an opportunity. Maybe tell us what can first time attendees expect if they were to come to Ted Fest.
Yeah, well, you know, it's really great for families, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, a family. But we do have for first-time attendees, you just kind of drive up through Wallsburg, follow the festival signs, you get up there, you get to the gate, you'll be greeted, by, you know, at the tent. They'll say, hey, what are you doing here? And are you here for Friday? Are you here for Saturday? Going camping? You know, they'll sell you a little ticket, and then they'll kind of direct you in. You'll drive in, and then you'll meet a parking guy, and he'll tell you what spot, you know, to go to. You know, if you're parking or if you're camping, they'll kind of tell you where to go. And you just kind of go wherever you're going. And then, you know, then you can kind of see the festival area down below. You just kind of walk down there. We've got some food trucks, some, you know, kind of, I guess, art vendors, you know, different people who have things. And then we've got like a, you know, a kind of a semicircle of tents that face the stage. And then you can kind of go in there. So there's some built-in shade. If you want to bring some chairs and sit there, that's good. Or, you know, blankets on the grass. And then, you know, that's kind of the idea. And then down below, there's a smaller stage in between. So if you see an act you want to go to, just, you know, you can, you know, either leave your stuff there and kind of go down a little further. You'll see this other stage down below. And then there's like a kids area there as well, where, you know, they have all these different games set up and, you know, people can go over there and play cornhole and this other, you know, game the kids just love. There's a water refill station. So if you, you know, bring water bottles, you can go over there and fill up your water. And that's, you know, basically the breakdown.
Yeah. And the fact that you have the two stages, I mean, you keep it pretty tight. I mean, one band's finishing, the other one's pretty much ready to go on the other stage.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That is a kind of a fun thing. I saw this at a big festival back east, and they had it set up that way. And when I came back, I said, hey, this is a really good idea. You know, and so, yeah, we have one band, you know, playing and performing, and then the other band will load on and kind of set up and get some line checks. And then as soon as the other band stops, you know, we got the other band up and running, you know, probably in a couple minutes. So it's really nice like that. Not a lot of sitting around.
Yeah. I want to make sure I mentioned the Beyond the Music. People really got to know about the, as you mentioned, the Richard Erickson Museum is out there. So it is a must-see, and I think it's with your ticket. It's free to walk through the buildings upon buildings upon buildings of, I mean, the coolest stuff. It's amazing.
Yes, that is actually a really good point. A couple things that you've even reminded me. Yeah, so on Saturday, if you are there on Saturday, the Richard Erickson Foundation, they have opened up their museum. And so you can go up there and see, you know, all these crazy, you know, they've got, you know, these old motorcycles that have been in different movies and, you know, different things like that. They've got, what have they got? They've got airplanes and old machines and all sorts of stuff. And that's really cool. Like an old printing press from Salt City. And then one of the other things that's kind of fun that people maybe haven't experienced or noticed, if you have been at these festivals, once the festival ends at like, 10, then usually you can just kind of wander around the different campsites and there'll be people jamming, you know, so you can kind of, you know, come up on people. There'll be a big group gathered around. They'll be jamming and singing songs. And so that's, you know, a lot of fun. So it just kind of continues into the night. And that's what people really love about it as well, is just, you know, the different, you know, you just kind of stay up and kind of play music together. You know, it's really fun.
Okay. Hey, Ryan, anything else you wanted to mention about it?
You know, I think one thing is it's a really great, I mean, we appreciate the support of everybody. And so, you know, we would just encourage people to come because, you know, the more we can support this, it just supports, you know, just growing this kind of event here. And it really, you know, for us, at least for now, we focus on, you know, showcasing just a ton of bands in this area. And we try and pick, you know, some of the the people we love and some of the best performers around. So it's really great because it just supports, you know, a lot of the bands around here. Oh, wow, that's really loud. Sorry about that. Hold on.
Well, I've got to wrap it up anyway, so, yeah.
Yeah, so it supports a lot of the local bands. So we encourage everybody to come support it. We really appreciate it.
Okay. Brian, appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Ryan Shoup is the musician and director of the TED Fest. TED Fest is a financial supporter of KPCW.